Okay, so my talk is dyspnea, and I guess dyspnea is fairly common, so I'll advance. Okay. Right, so dyspnea is by definition unpleasant sensation in breathing, and it has subjective or the experience breathing discomfort, and it has other components that like intuitively you think there is something wrong with pulmonary physiology, but it also has psychological, social, and the environmental factors. And so actually I guess when you are sort of calm and confident, and then your threshold for dyspnea will be high. So like respiratory, I guess, discomfort, you just accept it as part of the, let's say, physical activity. But some people, you know, they're unsure about their health status. Or that whole area, they're always worried about, let's say, recent epidemic of this swine flu. And then any discomfort, probably one would feel as if it's an important symptom requiring, you know, some dealing with it. Next slide, please. So, common complaint. So, in the Framingham study, you know Framingham, the large community study, where between 37 to 70 year old people experience the sensation of dyspnea between 6 to 27%. So, it's generally fairly wide. So, it is a healthy person. They can have the sensation of dyspnea. Apparently, that's one of the more common complaints presenting to the emergency room, and also that's similar in the doctor's room, you know, when they come. And the most common symptoms of those people complaining are asthma, myocardial dysfunction, COPD, or interstitial lung disease. Next slide. So this is I guess there are different grading system, but I'm being the pulmonologist, so I'm just showing you the American Thoracic Society grading system. So here, grade zero is none, and so no trouble walking up slight hill. So you're not talking about, you know, tremendous exercise. You're just talking about like walking up a little bit hill, and then they don't feel anything, then there's zero. Mild symptom of dyspnea is that when they get short of breath, hurrying up level or just a slight hill. So I guess it's probably appropriate for, you know, American population that we don't do a heck of a lot of physical things. So if you feel that, you know, that's mild. And then moderate is somebody who walks slower than they appear and then still gets short of breath. So it's really sort of age-adjusted type of thing. And then severe dyspnea is when they walk like even slow, you know, 100 yards or just a few minutes, they get short of breath, and so that's considered severe. Very severe is when they get out of breath, even dressing or undressing. I mean, that's as minimum activity as they come, you know, short of just dying, I guess. Next. And then this is fairly well worked out, that the analog scale, so it's like very similar to the pain scale, you know. So you can say, like you can have a line here, and then there's no breathlessness and extreme breathlessness, and the patient points it, and then you can measure it as that one way to do it. Or this is the same thing, but in a modified, and then so right down from down to the maximum, and then just dividing up to in between. So I guess when you are doing research, this is what we would use as you know, the linear, and then somebody pointing. Next slide, please. And that's reproducible. All right. That's I couldn't find a good good picture in the Google, so I really drew these things. So this is all kinds of conditions that can affect dyspnea. So obstruction, so large airway, small airway. So, you know, this is the actually pharyngeal airway, trachea, and going down all the way. And then obstruction in any level can cause dyspnea. The other one is a lung. Is in a way, like physiologically speaking, it's a coil spring, you know. But when we have stiff lung, interstitial lung disease, and then they get like a number of collagen deposition, so lung gets very stiff, so stiff lung. For us to breathe, that of course we have to expand the chest wall. So chest wall itself, you can have some kind of fibrothorax. You know, sometimes when, for instance, somebody has pleural empyema, and then when it heals by organizing it, and then lung may be perfectly okay, but chest wall will be sort of bound down by fibrotic, you know, scar. So they can have fibrotic changes. Now, you know, old times, a lot of people used to have kyphoscoliosis. Scoliosis. Fortunately, I see that much fewer, you know, but sometimes, I guess the old times when tuberculosis was very much more prevalent, and Pott's disease, and that they would develop severe kyphoscoliosis. So that would be like a scoliosis. I think the one that we probably see the most commonly is the obesity. So obesity, that is not part of chest wall, but we call chest wall because anything that interferes with the lungs. You know, so diaphragm being the main respiratory muscle, and then obesity, especially apple-shaped obesity, where the central obesity, and then that interferes with the diaphragmatic function. So that's probably one of the more common things that we see nowadays, especially in the Bronx. Respiratory pump defects is the muscles and the diffusion, same thing, pneumothorax, hyperinflation. So we'll spend more time on this. And then respiratory drive. So anything that causes drive more active, so hypoxia, acidosis, will make somebody breathe hard. And actually anything that makes one breathe hard will be perceived as the dyspnea. And then so hyperventilation, for instance, if somebody's anxious and they have hyperventilation syndrome, so they may have perfectly normal end organs, but they will perceive as shortness of breath. And that ventilation perfusion mismatch, like in COPD, and then they may breathe, but that's much of the breathing, maybe more than half of them are ineffective breathing, so they will sense as shortness of breath. So I just divided into different physiological categories and then enumerated. So mechanical interference with ventilation, obstruction. So like a medical condition would be asthma, emphysema, and the bronchial or tracheal stenosis would have obstruction, and a stiff lung, interstitial, and we already saw the diagram before, and then resistance to expansion, obesity, pleural thickening, and so forth. Next. And then, so respiratory pump, I guess the absolute weakness would be polio, but thank goodness we don't see polio that much anymore. I mean, I guess we, I don't know there was a case of polio in the United States last year. Neuromuscular disease, we often see the Guillain-Barré syndrome or myasthenia gravis. And then sometimes SLE or muscular dystrophy. Hyper and hypothyroidism, severe, they can really do that. And then I guess when a patient goes through multi-organ dysfunction in ICU setting, they can get that. And then relatively, so absolute, but relatively pleural effusion, pneumothorax, or hyperinflation can cause the pump defect. Increased drive, sounds like he's already repeating so much. Hypoxia can do that, metabolic acidosis, and the stimulation. So the intrapulmonary receptor, for instance, when somebody has pneumonia or pulmonary edema, they get tremendous afferent impulse through the vagus, and then they get shortness of breath. And actually, some masochistically actually blocked the afferent vagus, and they show that they could really block the shortness of breath in experimental conditions. So that's the important afferent impulse. Now, the ventilation perfusion mismatch I already mentioned before. So somebody who has emphysema, they may have large areas, doesn't have perfusion, so that's wasted ventilation. And the large vessel obstruction, like a pulmonary embolism, for instance, they can have the whole lung, not participating in gas exchange, and then they can have dyspnea. The psychological dysfunction, I think that's probably one of the, it's always hard to measure when the psychological dysfunction is overlying condition. So for instance, when you assess patients with asthma, that up to 25-30% of the asthmatics have, anxiety, panic component. So they have asthma, but it's on top of it. And sometimes patients have a hard time differentiating between anxiety component and the actually asthma component. And in fact, when I, like, this is the kind of thing, you know, I have no idea because I don't have either one of them. I don't have asthma, I don't have anxiety panic attack. And so I can think about it forever and then I'll never be able to really come up with a really decent idea how to deal with it. But when I ask some of the patients, who knows they have anxiety panic attack? And then when you ask them exactly how that starts and then ask them, some of them can offer, you know, fairly fruitful insight how to deal with it. But they themselves have a hard time telling, like they would start out wheezing and tight, and then later they're just as short of breath, and then they cannot tell their condition is worsening. Like for instance, a patient who has pretty bad attack in the morning, with asthma in the morning. You know, typically they have trouble at night in the morning. So they try to help themselves, and then they're not getting anywhere, so decide to come to the emergency room. And then in the emergency room, of course, we give, you know, like, continuous nebulization, repeated, and then maybe they'll give epinephrine and something else. And then they should really get better, but they subjectively think they're getting worse. And they cannot tell which one is which. And only if they did objective measurement, like a peak floor, and then the number went up, then we know asthma itself is getting better. But sometimes doctors in the emergency room think that they don't need anything to evaluate. They think the patient is getting worse without measurement. And then patient is not sure, and the doctor is sure that the patient is getting worse. And then they end up getting intubated. And it's very frustrating because afterwards when I check, they were really not badly obstructed at all. So it was really error in judgment. But you know, how to undo this kind of thing? I mean, how to prevent this? You know, like I think when we have some humility, and then we always think that we may not know for sure, and that we want some objective measure to support, I mean, buttress our clinical notion. Then you know, we have backing up, but some young doctors are so damn sure that they don't need anything, and then we end up doing this kind of thing. Anyway, the mechanism of dyspnea is a sensory system, and actually, I guess we perceive this sensation coming from when we actually, it's like the loop type of thing. So when you're out of breath, we send out the signal in the medulla. And then mainly the vagus, so the phrenic nerve and the contraction. And then when we send out the signal, we expect lung to expand so much. Now obstruction is too much, and then even though the contraction is good, but air movement may not be enough, so they don't get that feedback in the lungs that we are getting enough expansion. That's one. Or if you have stiff lung, that given stimulation, but they may not expand. So then we sense that, and then that's considered to be dyspnea. Next, please. So when we evaluate this patient with dyspnea, we get history and physical examination, and then we usually want to know specific activity that causes dyspnea. And then we mentioned about this quantitation, like a Bogue scale or like a analog scale. And then the other part is how the dyspnea interfere with daily life. And so this is not just obstruction per se, but we are looking at the whole, you know, how it impairs life quality. And then the biggest differential really is it the heart or the lung? Because that's a major thing that causes dyspnea. And I'm going to spend mostly on the lung. You know? So we do pulmonary function studies, we do lung volume and race, diffusing capacity, we may do blood gases, and then exercise testing to see what causes dyspnea. And then usually, this is unlike the patients with heart disease. Usually the patient stops testing because their shortness of breath blocks them doing it. Sometimes we may do a bronchial challenge if they're like, for instance, asthmatics, they're asymptomatic and their perfect lung function is perfectly normal, then we may do actually methacholine challenge type of thing. And the third one, if we suspect pump being part of the problem, and then we ask them to cause maximum expiratory and maximum inspiratory pressure to check the respiratory muscle, you know, the strength. And the imaging studies we do is ventilation perfusion scan, and then, you know, you are familiar with it when we do the pulmonary embolism workup, although in Jacobi we don't do so much of that. And then we made a chest CT or high resolution CT, especially when we are suspecting interstitial lung disease. And the gallium scan, sometimes we do it, especially when we suspect, for instance, sarcoidosis. And then diaphragmatic function, we do the diaphragmatic fluoroscopy. And then cardiac evaluation, as you know, we do echocardiogram and a dovitamine stress test, thallium perfusion scan, and then we may even do cardiac catheterization. Other hospitals often, when they present with shortness of breath in the emergency room, they do BNP, but we are cheap, so we don't do it. Next, please. Other things special is sleep studies, we may do it. Some people do, when you suspect reflux as a component, and then esophageal pH monitor. In fact, overnight or 24 hours. And the ENT examination, especially we suspect upper airways obstruction. And the psychological assessment, it's not always that easy to say. Like you can say somebody has component of anxiety panic attacks, but actually, we don't really know what is the prevalence of anxiety panic attacks in the general population. And I'm sure there's a difference in sex and age group and racial, you know, the ethnic group, you know. So when you find it, that may be just neither here nor there. But anyway, some people doing research basis they do that. In fact, at Jacobi, we have a psychologist who is interested in doing this on asthmatics and panic attacks. So, the treatment of dyspnea, so like central perception, so if they know that it comes from cognitive, emotional, and behavioral aspects, and then by educating what is happening to them, and then if you, for instance, teach them how to cope with anxiety, maybe that'll help them. But I'm not really sure that this central component is actually, there hasn't been enough, validated research. And then I think maybe I wish psychologists or psychiatrists would probably do some studies among our patients. Next slide. So asthma. When they're dyspneic, then of course we want to do reverse airflow obstruction and the chest tightness, same thing. And then some patients, cough is a main component, so we sometimes use cough medicine or local anesthetics to control cough. And then this anxiety component. And some patients, you know, they're so anxious. An example that I told you about emergency rooms. They really look like they're going to die, you know. So if we could somehow selectively control their anxiety only, and then when they are not particularly that, you know, obstructed, and then maybe we could deal with it. But nowadays, any kind of anxiolytic or narcotics in a patient who has acute asthma is considered to be contraindicated. You know, so unless somebody comes up with a study to prove that it's valid the mode of therapy, that is considered to be the contraindicated. Next, please. So reduced resistive load, so reverse bronchoconstriction, and then same thing. In the pharmacotherapy, usually beta-2 agonists, short-acting, long-acting, anticholinergics, theophylline, so theophylline is in COPD. I think it's a mix, this, yeah, so COPD, when they have the dyspnea, then reverse airflow obstruction, and then hyperinflation, and then exercise. So hyperinflation, the patients with COPD, they have the air trapping, right? So they're like, so I'm talking about severe COPD. So when they're severe COPD, when you breathe, and then it takes a long time to exhale, but they're short of breath, so they don't wait until they exhale the same amount, and then they breathe in again. And then before they exhale, you breathe in again. So you keeping up, stacking up the air. So you could easily stack up a liter of air. So usually, like for instance, my, you know, functional residual capacity, or let's put it, the resting lung volume is down here. So when I breathe in and they go down, up and they go down again. But patients with COPD may go up and then go down pathways and go up again and go down pathways. And then eventually they are fully inflated and that they're breathing maybe only 500 ml from the top. So it's really effort, you know, very difficult to keep on maintaining breathing because it's already hyperinflated. And in fact, as I mentioned to you, I don't have COPD, so I don't know what the sensation is like. But you know, one day I tried to see how it must be like. So instead of resting, I inhale all the way up, and then instead of exhaling normally, I just try to exhale half a liter, and then try to maintain it at full inspiration. And very tiring, you know. And then in fact, when I measured the oxygen consumption for an experiment like that for a while, I don't remember how long, I did it maybe an hour. And so I consumed about a liter of oxygen per minute. You know, usually we use 350 ml per minute, right? But to maintain that large lung volume required tremendous, like almost like exercising. And you know, so they did get tired, you know, so somehow if you make them exhale to the normal volume, and then it will be easier again. But patient went up there, stacked up there because they're short of breath, and then they're breathing. So asking them not to breathe, it's like it makes no sense. You know, you tell them to stop breathing, I mean, they will think they are completely crazy. I mean, you know, so somehow if you give them chance to exhale, that's tremendous. But I don't know how to do it. So I would tell the patient, so if you tell them not to breathe so much, I mean, how can you not breathe so much when you're out of breath? So one way I've been doing is that if you don't give so much time to breathe. So if, let's say, instead of having full 60 seconds to breathe, if I took 30 seconds away from their respiratory time, then they wouldn't be breathing so much. So one way I've tried, is that I tell the patient, follow me, and then I do it like this. So it means I'm exhaling, you know, long, but I don't tell them exhaling because that they don't understand what you're talking about, but I tell them to imitate what I do, and then say, and then they do it, and then I'll gradually make it longer and longer, you know. So they think that I'm just joking, but making noise, but that means I'm taking time away from breathing, you know, and then by doing that. So if the patient with asthma and COPD both, when they are very short of breath, they have this air trapping. And then if the patient is willing to follow you, and then if you can do that, they really change just like that. It takes only 5 minutes to reverse. So I've had several cases where patient is ready to be intubated, and then I'll go over there and they okay. I tell, you know, like, you really have to gain confidence, and that total strength, they think they're gonna die, and then you tell them to follow me, and then I start doing something like that, they think completely, you know, unreliable, they will never follow you. But some, maybe one out of two, they're sort of gullible, I guess, so they do follow me, you know, and then so I'll tell them, and then that really makes all the difference. And then I want you to, next time when you have somebody who has really bad COPD or bad asthma, and then you think that there are people getting prepared to intubate, and then you try this, you know, that, and then there's a very good chance that you'll be able to reverse that obstruction. But if you do peak flow, and the peak flow is less than 100, forget about it, that patient's gonna require intubation. But peak flow is still greater than 100, but less than 150, that patient has a little bit of room, and then if you by exhaling, you can really actually, you know, reverse it. You've heard of pursed-lip breathing, right? Pursed-lip breathing is, they do like this. A lot of patients, like the way I'm making noise, you know, but patients do it like that. And then so there, in the patients with chronic obstructive lung disease usually do that. And then in fact, the respiratory therapy, so physical therapy used to teach them, or some patients actually invent on their own. So I've had, I think one out of three, when you ask them, who taught you that? And then they say, oh, I did it myself. And then they think that it's no big deal, you know, but why are you doing it? And I find it a little bit helpful. So they do that. But that's sort of, in a way, similar, because they're taking long time to exhale. And then by using long time to exhale, you are sort of unburdening your lung, you know, air trapping. So it really helps them. So anyway, that's one way to do it. And then the other one is exercise rehabilitation. You know, when you think about it, exercise, all of us do exercise. We are talking about not fancy exercises, walking around. Then all of us know how to walk. But apparently, patients, when they exercise the rehab and then just walk with them, somehow patients learn to walk more efficiently. So I guess when you, so like a normal person, when you walk, you know, we use so much energy. And then when you go through this exercise program, I guess they walk probably more smoothly and then efficiently. So same walking, the oxygen consumption will drop about 30%. So it's really amazing, you know, that they would learn to become much more efficient. But not only that, like energy expenditure becomes more efficient, but patient develops confidence being able to do it. Because I guess when they get out of breath, walking from to end of the hallway, and then a lot of these patients describe attack. You know, what do you mean by attack? And it's like a little bit like a panic attack. You know, they like lose control of it, and then they get like completely like panic stricken. And they say they don't know they're breathing in or out. I mean, that's really so ridiculous. I mean, that's sort of like natural thing, but they are so short of breath they don't know what to do. But this is exercise rehab. I guess it's sort of like conditioning. So they sort of giving them opportunity to think about it and then do it sort of relaxed fashion. So it really, it doesn't really improve their lung function, but in terms of being able to do activities, really remarkable improvement. So that's the effective thing for COPD. Now the other one is lung volume reduction surgery. You've heard about lung volume reduction surgery, right? So lung volume reduction surgery is actually like patients with emphysema or COPD. When you do high resolution CT scan, there's some patients, actually maybe about a third of the patient have emphysema mainly in the upper lobe. rest of the lung is relatively, not completely normal, but not that bad. But upper third is really bad. So, and then the other part is this patient is so hyperinflated. I mentioned to you, you know, now they're breathing way up in the fully inflated state. So if you could remove this emphysematous lung, one third, and then the remaining lung will be, you know, normally stretched, and then they will work more efficiently. And so they've done this lung volume reduction surgery on patients with severe emphysema. And then actually, it turned out that only patients with emphysema who benefited from this lung volume reduction surgery is a patient who has emphysema in the upper lobe. And surgery itself is there are two large groups. One is that sternum splitting, and then take out 30% of the lung by, you know, the stapling and both sides. So 30%, 30%, the remaining lung gets for the stretch. And so that's one way to do it. Some other places used actually laser, and so, you know, destroy that upper emphysematous lung by using carbon dioxide laser and then contracting it. And I think sternum splitting procedure is probably a little more effective than the other laser therapy. But anyway, the goal is removing 30% of the lung from the both apices. It's largely destroyed lung. The remaining lung gets much more stretched and then work more effectively. And so when they did this surgery, it turns out that only about 4% of the patients with COPD actually are candidates for that, you know. But those patients who did that, it benefited from it. So most of the patients with COPD obviously is not candidate, because only 4% is that candidate. Oxygen therapy, as you know, when the oxygen saturation is less than 89%, or PO2 55 or less, or PO2 less than 60 with core pulmonary or polycythemia, and then they get oxygen therapy. And actually, the large number, meaning 240 patients, when they NIH-sponsored study, I think 30 years ago, showed that when they use oxygen, their survival is better. Now, NIH is doing another study, much larger scale, but I think that's going to take another 5 years. Patients who come in with acute exacerbation, they can benefit from non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, right? BiPAP, you know, and so once who come in with acute exacerbation, and when you give oxygen therapy, some of the patients develop hypercapnia and then obtundation, and then they need intubation. So those patients, when we give oxygen and then they are at risk of developing that trouble, then they would benefit from non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Now, mild patients, there is no risk of ever developing this hypersomnolence, or I mean CO2 retention and hypersomnolence. So you don't really have to do that. But ones who is at risk of developing CO2 retention, and then I think they would benefit from this non-invasive therapy. Or if we treat their obstructive lung disease and they improve their VQ, ventilation perfusion mismatch, then they usually would benefit. But usually it takes, I don't think any of our therapy improved right away, and it takes few weeks to improve. And then if you could somehow tone down the respiratory drive so they don't have to breathe so much, that would be, that may benefit from it, because I mentioned to you, if they're breathing so hard and they're breathing hard, so they're short of breath. So if they don't breathe so hard by suppressing it, that they won't feel so uncomfortable. And so it looks like a good idea, but nobody did this kind of study in acute exacerbation. You know, I mean, you already they are having trouble, and then you give benzodiazepine or opiate, you really knock them off. But when they're in stable state, actually in the experimental condition, when patient comes in and then you give, they've done, somebody by the name of Woodcock. Woodcock did study using opiates, like what is it, codeine type of compounds. So patient comes in and then they would either take, so he compared codeine, something like codeine 45 milligram was, so that was, or the coffee, or alcohol, or placebo. And then I guess it probably would be hard to, you know, hide, but it was still done, you know, blind fashion. And then make them walk on the treadmill. And then it turns out that in an acute setting like that, that coffee, I mean, placebo and coffee didn't make any difference, and then alcohol either. But apparently opiate, patients felt much better, and that they were able to walk more. You know, I'm talking about fairly bad COPD. So acute setting, opiate, the codeine 45 milligram, sounded like a fairly effective way to reduce shortness of breath. But when they did this study, in a larger scale study in the VA hospital, that when you give old COPDs, narcotics regularly, that they got into a lot more trouble, because a lot of them had constipation, obtundation, hospitalization, and some intubation. So acute study in the laboratory setting was not transferable to general patients with COPD. Another one, they used this benzodiazepine, and some patients, like one group of patients with emphysema, they used Valium, and then apparently four patients improved remarkably. But when they did it in a large number of patients, apparently, again, it didn't bear out. So, I was thinking, perfectly healthy person, if you give Valium, let's say, 5 milligrams 3 times a day, all about, like, a perfectly healthy person, some subject may feel better, some subject may feel worse, I think. Some people a little more anxious. Well, within normal range, they may feel calmer, and then they may function better, whereas other people may not. So I think COPD, they didn't look at that, emotional condition part. They just studied any COPD, and I would think that COPD has the spectrum just like a normal person. And I think that I wish somebody would revisit those topics after, considering patients anxiety state and then COPD. Maybe they would benefit from it. Next slide, please. So I think I finished it. Okay. So I think I covered. Also, so actually, the other part is shortness of breath. Is if the breathing itself causes shortness of breath. So if you somehow you could breathe less, then you won't feel as short of breath. I know it sounds like you're talking about circular type of reasoning, but somehow, so for instance, if you, the patients with obstructive lung disease, the main respiratory drive is carbon dioxide, right? That's causing, respiratory center stimulation, and then we're breathing at a certain level. And if we could somehow make that respiratory center tolerate higher CO2, and then you don't breathe as much, and then you would feel less short of breath. So it's sort of like a central drive, the modifying central drive. And so we don't do anything about airways obstruction, but just not breathing so much would feel less short of breath. So I think it does make sense that somehow suppressing, reducing respiratory drive would make sense. The other one is that if we don't produce carbon dioxide as much, you know, so reducing metabolic output. Or if we reduce dead space, so each breath is more efficient, you know, instead of like a COPD, 50% of the tidal volume is wasted breathing. So if it somehow improve that, and then they don't have to breathe so much, and then that in turn will make them as less short of breath. Hypoxia, we are giving oxygen for that, and the metabolic acidosis, somehow if we could correct acidosis per se, we could reduce demand, and then they would feel less short of breath. Next slide, please. So, exercise training in the normal person is so it improves aerobic capacity, and then reduce lactic acid generation at the break point, you know, at the end of the exercise, I guess termination. And then they don't feel as short of breath, and that they can do more exercise. But the patients with lung disease, usually they can reduce this breathing just by actually reducing respiratory rate, you know. So like most of the training is making them slow and the slow and the deeper breathing by, and then I guess that improves the ventilation perfusion matching, and then that in turn turn out to be overall minute ventilation decrease, and that they felt less short of breath. And oxygen, supplemental oxygen during exercise is reduced lactate generation. But in patients with COPD, their short of breath, I mean shortness of breath is a limiting factor, so they usually don't produce lactate even when they break exercise. That's in, you know, contrast to normal person, you and I do exercise testing, or even cardiac patients, so they will develop lactate. So I think I covered this about the decreasing central drive. So sometimes when they inhale lidocaine, that somehow it reduces respiratory drive, and then that they don't feel as short of breath. The other one they use is when you use like a fan. So some patients like with a lot of shortness of breath, they would bring in a fan in the hospital, and then they're blowing their face. So what are they doing? And they say when air blows in their face, they feel less short of breath. And or sometimes they blow on their nose. So actually, it's sort of like a little bit of air blowing in their face helps their shortness of breath. But when they go out in the cold air and then blast of air, they get short, they increase shortness of breath. And they, in fact, this is actually fairly well, it's an easy thing to test. And then actually, patients tell you, that's why they bring in this fan. And then I know it sounds ridiculous, but you cannot say anything about the sensation, because patient senses, and you don't sense yourself, you know. And then I mentioned already about the respiratory pattern. Next. I think I'll stop at the past there. As I mentioned about opiates, actually, just a second. I think everything. Okay. Hmm? Yeah. So I think I already mentioned this anxiolytics. So if we select the patient with the anxiety component as being large, and then actually, you know, by allaying anxiety, they feel less short of breath. And actually, I had a protocol, IRB, you know, the approved protocol, where patient has marked anxiety, and then looks like they're going to really start breathing. But when you do peak flow, and the peak flow is greater than 100, and then that patient I wanted to use the morphine, sulfate versus placebo. You know, morphine is the most effective anxiolytic. I mean, everybody accepts that, you know. So, and then by doing that, I wanted to see if I could really, you know, the sensation, and then so avoid intubation. And actually, it was based on the observation where one of the patients was really sick, and that the peak flow was less than 100, and then we decided to intubate. And so just before we decided to intubate, we gave intravenous Valium, you know, to calm the patient down and intubate. As it turns out, after we gave Valium, we couldn't intubate. So anesthesiologist tried over and over, and then like a patient struggling like crazy, and then, you know, but I couldn't really make him stop trying. But anyway, several times, and he said, okay, let's wait and give patient a few minutes break before they try again. So while I'm waiting, and so patient already received the Valium, so I'm really scared to death the patient is going to stop breathing. And patient looked very much better than before. So I thought, I was really tempted not to intubate, but, you know, we had already set out to intubate and give the Valium, so we couldn't just reverse the course. So afterwards, what if we gave Valium as a therapy? I mean, you know, like prospectively. So we decided, okay, we'll do that, we'll try that as an experiment. But why not morphine? Because morphine is even more effective than Valium. So we set up the protocol, and then one patient came in, and then again, I was just walking by, and then in ICU, they were trying to, all the doctors were gathered around, getting ready to intubate. So I asked them to stop, and then let me check the peak flow, and then the peak flow was 110. So okay, this is the patient. So I gave her morphine, 5 milligrams, and then 10 minutes later, another 5 milligram. And patient just turned around like that, and then patient asked me, what did you give me? That's the best thing. I didn't tell her what I gave her, because I didn't want to make her get into an addict, you know. But I thought, wow, this is really tremendous. So my protocol is that I have to study 5 patients. And then if I have 5, you know, prospective randomized study, I could publish it. But as it turns out, waiting for this protocol, the study, I could never find them. So, you know, when doctors think they need intubation, they just intubate. They don't start calling me to come up and do the study. So after I waited and waited, after about 5 years, that I had to give up, because the IRB is giving me trouble, you know, because this is the study involving narcotics. And so the FDA is looking at it, and then so if you cannot really recruit, you know, why don't you give up, and then you can do another time. So I had to give up that study. But I know this kind of patient exists, you know, but I don't really know how to go about doing that study, you know, prospectively. But I mentioned to you about benzodiazepine, similar to that. Next slide, please. I think I covered most of them, so I'll stop there. Okay. All right, thanks. Somehow, I think this is coming around. I'll tell you about it. I hear all about it.